Accession number 28650, Mr. Gordon Mellor, Reel 8. Now, we're going through this. I'm using this album you've got as a sort of aid memoir. It is not necessarily going to appear in the War Museum, though, so
don't look for it.
There's a mention of off-duty activities, which is somewhat unusual as a sort of log rolling and fishing, various forms of things that are what I would call Canadian style activities. Did you do much of this sort of thing?
Well, the camp, as you already know, was not very far from the lake, and not far from the one edge of the aerodrome. There was also a river, nine mile. Names that escape me.
Doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't. Anyhow, the river passed underneath the Blue Water Highway, and down some rocks, and it then ran in into the lake itself, so that we had a river and river mouth close by, and we also had the lake available. It was a very good beach all the way along there, and the pines. Trees and what have you came down almost to the water's edge in some places. It was we had time in evening off-duty hours, and we used to go across the fields on the farm track and have for evening. Sometimes it was earlier in the day if we got a day off, which came occasionally. And one could swim and frolic around if you so minded. That description about log rolling is merely I believe the lumberjacks do that sort of thing in part of their work in controlling logs in the logging areas on the rivers. But this was just a sort of a mild attempt at seeing what it was like.
Seems to be doing quite well there.
Well, yeah, there were two young chaps from the from course 9 who'd been with us in Aberystwyth, but they weren't particularly friends of mine. I just knew them well, so to speak.
Now, the course goes on to the Astro Navigation course, the sort of next thing on, goes on to, well, mid-August, 41.
Yes, that was...
That seems to be about it.
We spend quite a bit of time night flying there. We had done night flying during the main basic navigation course, but then, of course, it was easy enough to pick your way because of the lights from all the towns and the cities and along certain roads. One could almost have had made a star map of it. To navigate by, but with this astro course, then the night work was different in as much as it was to emphasise the ability to take sights and work out positions and then use them to alter course to your next destination point and to see if you got there. The accuracy was not great. If you could get within eight miles or thereabouts of your destination point after a couple of hours on doing it on Astro, you seem to be doing it quite well. But it was another tool hand that on occasions it if everything else has gone and you're up in part of the sky where you can see the stars and that you recognise, then it was, as I say, an added tool to get you additional information.
So that's fundamentally the end of the course. You do pass that course as well.
Yes.
Things. It didn't seem clear whether you're recommending for further specialist navigation or not. It looks like not, but I mean, I can't quite understand. Let's go.
That was all that was available in Canada.
Right. So the next thing is you move on to the next phase in your training as an observer, which is your bombing and gunnery.
That's right.
Now, that you do it also in Ontario, but that's at number 4 Bombing and Gunnery School, Fingal.
Fingal, that is the word place.
And you start that in August 1941.
Yes, it was a straight train journey. We left Goderich. I think we travelled in a... The train was fairly full. I think we travelled in the luggage compartment for part of the journey. Anyhow, we got to Fingal, and the station was, what, 4 or 5 miles away, I suppose, from the aerodrome, so we had transport out there. This was an RCAF establishment, and they had different ideas
about
behaviour. Oh, well, they had, it was not quite so easy going as it was at Port Albert. They had areas where you had to march to attention, and the saluting bit was a rigorously used.
Did you resent that after what you'd been used to?
Not really. If you were out around the living quarters, then I don't think there was any difference from what we'd already experienced. But if you were anywhere near the parade ground or station headquarters or the like, then then you had to march wherever you were going and not walk. It was a very pleasant place, but it was much further south, and of course it was that amount hotter as well. So we were in midsummer there, but I think we enjoyed ourselves there. The routine was quite similar to that at Port Albert, sort of lectures on guns and of all sorts, various sorts, and how to strip them down again, how to clean them. There was also the variety of types which were we were likely to come across. And also then parallel with it, then we had lectures on bombing problems, bombs, various sorts, mechanisms of fuses, and also there came to the question of using bomb sights and the like.
Let's do the guns first. So which guns were you introduced to?
Oh, well, it was largely the Vickers GAO. Was the
gas operator?
Yes,
that was the main one, not the Browning one.
No, the Browning was no, I don't think we ever had the Browning on a movable mounting. The Brownings were largely used with turrets,
of course. So now tell me about the Vickers GO gun. What was it like?
Well, it was very light. It was quite lightweight, in actual fact, and it had a rather slim magazine on the top, which you had to fill by hand, of course, with a into the clips. At least I think so. So long since I've seen the inside of this stuff, and it was quite a simple sight. There was nothing optical about it at all. It was purely a sight and a point at the end of the barrel. We learnt about deflection.
Hang on. What was it like to strip down? Were you doing? Were the stoppages that they had to sort of? How was it prone to stoppages?
It happened occasionally. It didn't seem to happen very often, as far as I was concerned. I don't think Johnny King had any trouble with it either. It was seemed to be a pretty reliable sort of weapon.
Now, how did they teach you deflection shooting and sights generally?
This was largely, I think, by pushing it on, positioning the centre. It was a cross and a ring round it, and you used it was, I don't know, I think the rings of various size were given, they were given various speeds. I think 100 mile an hour ring was something about that big or something, and you had a cross in the middle with another circle and a small viewpoint to look through. And under certain conditions, then you put the nose of the aircraft on the outside ring, If it was further away, then it had to be further. You had to use your judgment.
Did they do any? I mean, the gunners used to practice with clay pigeons and things like that to sort of teach them practically what, you know,
yes,
with a shotgun.
Yes,
whatever.
Yes, indeed.
Did you do any of that?
No, I don't recall doing it. I do recall having a go at it when I was on the squadron.
Okay.
But not there at that time.
So that's on the ground, stripping, learning about the Vickers GO, a bit about deflection.
Yes.
Now, yes. What did you learn about bombs?
We also did. There were firing ranges, of course.
You fired it on the ground.
Yeah, you had yes, you had a bit of a practice on the ground, and we. I think we did something on the Browning, under those circumstances. But it didn't seem to be a major part of the course.
So let's move to the groundwork on the bombs. So there's the different types of bombs. Did you actually learn what was going on inside them?
Well, there was sectional diagrams available in the lecture room and lecture hall, and where they got the samples as well. And that showed where the fuses were screwed in, either in the side or in the nose or even in the tail fuse. And we mainly learnt about the capacity of various types of bombs, and whether they were armour piercing or whether they were GP bombs of general sort of general purpose, which would if they hit a hard surface like a road, then the fuse would then sort of set it off. Whereas with an armour piercing, then of course there was it had a shock wave to when it hit the target to and passed through it before it went off.
And what about you? You were introduced to the bomb sights as well.
Oh yes, yes. We had the old one which was being used pre-war. I imagine it was Mark 9. And there was a compass bowl, and there was a post which you with a slider up and down, and there was a bar in front with some wires on either side, and the use of the wires parallel with the main arm of the projection, you had to get your target passing down, and those wires there assisted you in adjusting the aircraft heading so the target passed down the centre of the wires. And also it had as far as I can recall, it also had a movable markers along the main sort of post sticking out, and having adjusted those all in accordance with your height and speed and the propensities of the particular design of bombs, to whether it went a long way forward or not. When it came together, you sort of looked through the sight on the vertical post to the sights on the horizontal one, and the target came down the wires, and you gave instructions to the pilot to turn left or bear right.
You practice this on the ground first, learning the principles of
it. That's it. Yes, we did.
And there's things like a demonstration bomb rack you were doing as well. I mean, I presume that's just. Would you be actually learning how to put them on, or is that the armourer's job?
Well, that is basically the armourer's job. But I think one was supposed to observe that or know what was going on. There was. You never knew, I suppose, under war conditions, whether you would be called upon to do that function or not. But we certainly learnt the mechanics of and this is how they were lifted up as well. I mean, mostly when we were at the bombing gunnery school, then of course we only used practice bombs, which were 11 pounds, I think. £9?
One other thing.
Not anyhow.
One other thing on the ground is this. You seem to have been exposed to a decompression chamber for high altitude research. Now, that's at London, Ontario, which is not that far away from Fingal.
No.
What was this about? Because that's not nice in some ways.
Well, it's. I think they asked for volunteers. I'm not really sure. Anyhow,
did you volunteer?
Yeah. I mean, say they explained what was wanted, and decided. Yes, we went. Several of us went, and to the hospital where this decompression chamber was situated, and the hospital doctors were involved, and. We went into this big cylinder, which was quite a small room. It could house the doctor and two trainees, and we were given exercises, things like counting money or writing words or mental exercises at normal pressures. And then we did these exercises as we went up. Sometimes we had oxygen with us until we got to quite a high equivalent level, and other times we just went gradually up and see the effect on us when we got above 10,000.
This was high altitude research?
Yes.
Now, how did it affect you? Were you aware of it affecting
you? No, this was entirely new to us. As to what it was, and it was quite amazing what the lack of oxygen at 25,000 feet can make people do.
In what way?
Oh, well, we sort of one of the exercises, because they only had one person without oxygen at the time. If there were two of you and the doctor in the cabin thing, so that one of us was compos mentis and the other one was suffering. And you say, lend us a dollar or something like that. And you'd fiddle around and you'd pull a dollar out and give it to you. Or you would give him a dollar in the reverse direction. And when he'd done the exercise and they put him back on oxygen and he came round, and he wouldn't know anything about it. So if you'd given him a dollar and wanted it back, it wasn't necessarily easy to get it. He wouldn't know anything about it. And it would affect your judgment as far as navigation was concerned very considerably. But we went two or three times and we did the exercises that the doctors laid down for us.
Now, what about the aeroplane flights? What aircraft were you in? Was it the Anson again or was it
No, we were on flying on ferry battles there.
Now, what did you think of that? Firstly, the aircraft, because it's quite a controversial aircraft, isn't it? Did you think of the ferry battle?
Well, a sort of normal cross-country speeds. I've been with the Anson was, 125, 130 miles per hour or thereabouts. We then got into the ferry battle, which I thought was very cramped. The pilot was up in front, immediately behind the engine, and then there was a sort of a greenhouse arrangement on the down the spine of the aircraft to where you came to in the middle position, where there was a open cockpit with a scarf ring on which you mounted your machine gun. If you were on bomb dropping, then of course you were down in the bowels of the suit fuselage, and there was a track there, and the bomb site, usually the Mark 9, nothing more advanced than that, although they did tell us about American bomb sites, but not very much at the time. And You dropped your bombs from that site. I thought the aircraft was underpowered. We never had any trouble with it. Or at least the pilot didn't tell us that we'd had a dodgy trip. But it all seemed to be pretty reliable. Very slow. I mean, 120 miles an hour is a day bomber is no good, even for low level.
Now, what about your bombing and machine gun exercises? How did they test your bombing and, well, do you want to do bombing first or machine
gun? Well, yes. Well, on the machine gunning part, then, of course, there was a second aircraft involved, and he went up first, a matter of a couple of minutes or so, or he already may already be up on the bomb lines. But we went out over the lake, and he would fly a straight line from A to B, and we would then form eight on him, and he would then string a toad,
a drogue,
on a wire, and he'd trail it, probably 100 yards behind or something like that, and we'd fire at the drogue, and the ammunition had got a colour, so that if two of you were doing the exercise, then you'd have each have a drum, and one would be blue and the other would be red, so that if you hit the drogue, then it would leave a mark, so that when the drogue was dropped over the aerodrome, when it was then looked at and the hits counted up, they knew whether they were red or blue, and that corresponded to one or other of the trainees. As far as the that was concerned, I don't think we were very good. We did get hits, but we weren't all that good at it. Still, it gave us the experience of firing and dealing with the problem of firing from a moving moving platform.
Now, the other thing is bombing tests, presumably on the bombing range.
Yes, well, that was triangular target in the lake, and the pilot sort of approached the target, but it wasn't an ideal situation because the hatch in the bottom of the aircraft was not all that big, so you hadn't got a great forward view at all, and if you were down below 6,000 feet, then it suddenly appeared. And it depended entirely upon the skill or the pilot's idea of heading directly towards it, because suddenly it would appear coming out of the corner. If you were lucky, it was coming down the middle of the edge of the hatch. So it suddenly appeared into view, and you had the bomb sight in front, and you had to direct him onto the target from that situation. The more modern aircraft, the bigger aircraft, had much more forward vision.
Now this would be on targets in Lake Erie, would it?
That's right.
Now, so you had difficulty with this?
You got used to it. I mean, say the first ones we had, the bombs were a fair way off, but they had a incentive, in as much as it was called the Pickle Barrel Club.
And why?
And it was there was a little badge available, on it is a pickle barrel, which is, you know, like an ordinary beer barrel, except it was used for storing pickles, and purely an American thing. And if you hit the target, then you became a member. So there was an incentive. Hit the target, which I did. I did it twice in one go, but I don't think they allowed one of them, or somehow or other. Anyhow, I hit it a sufficient number of times to become a member. I've still got the badge somewhere upstairs, probably with the scout badge and what have you.
Any other type of bombing or air practice, or was that it?
No, that was it. There was the standard smoke bombs, which we dropped from varying heights. We didn't get any low-level bombing practice at all. So that had to be something for later on. But I think about the highest we dropped bombs, that practice bombs, was 10,000 feet. We didn't use oxygen at that level, whereas on the nav courses, then you started to do so, but we didn't go above. And largely, the period we were there was practical work. We got a fair number of.
Did you use a camera gun in sort of where they have mock attacks by fighters?
No, that wasn't. We weren't involved with that at all.
Anything else you did? Because you weren't there that long, were you?
No.
It's a month and a half, from the looks of it.
The most.
So September 41.
Yes, we were entirely involved just with the two items of bombing and gunnery and such exercises as they gave us. We got around a bit of social life, but largely it was fairly isolated. We stayed most of the time. We stayed on the camp, except there was a sports day, I think, and we sort of.
What do you remember of that?
That was largely for the benefit of course, the permanent staff of the camp. But we took part in some of the events, and also we used to play the odd football match with them. At the same time, they expected us to have a go at softball, which is the same as baseball, but the obvious thing, the ball was not so hard.
Was this partly to keep fit, or was it just for fun?
Bit of each, I suppose. Bit of each. We didn't do any cross-country running or anything like that, and we hadn't done so at Port Albert either. We did feel the heat a bit.
Now, you've got your... here at the end of the course, the end of September, you pass in both in both bombing and in firing, gunnery. Sorry. Now at that point, you're promoted to sergeant observer. Now
That
a big thing? I mean, you've been training a long time.
Oh yeah, that was the aiming point at that time. Never mind about beyond. The whole object was to get through the whole lot and. Get the half wing, which has got various names, and we had previously attended a passing out ceremony of a New Zealand course, and the then Prime Minister of New Zealand happened to be in Canada, so he turned up at Fingal and presented the young observers, using observers with their badges and what have you, and they in turn sort of encircled him and performed what is it, haka they call it. Yes, there was quite a mixture of native New Zealanders and the British immigrants.
And what about your passing out parade? What was that like?
Oh, we had a general to come and give our do us. Yes, it was quite a ceremonial marching and what have you, band, and we each approached the general, and he had a few words for each of us, asked us where we came from, and. Pinned on the observer's badge, and you saluted smart turn, and away. And the other chap was on his way in to do the same. So he did the whole lot of us for the two for our course. I would say that the number 9 course at Port Albert went to a different bombing gunnery school. They went to Picton.
So which was you in number 10.
So it was just number 10 course that went to
number 4
Fingal, yes.